Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us to discuss the week in Washington and beyond are Dr. Gordon Adams of the Quincy Institute think tank, Byron Callen of Capital Alpha Partners, an independent Washington research firm, Michael Hurston of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, former Pentagon Comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who, among his many other hats, is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and our very own Chris Cervello, a retired United States Navy commander and public affairs officer, who's not only our producer, but the co-founder of the ProVision Advisors PR firm. Everybody, thanks very, very much for joining us.
Glad to be here, Vago.
Thank you, Vago.
Always a pleasure.
Great to be back.
Indeed. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA is sponsoring our land warfare coverage. Our coverage of AUSA Now, the Association of the United States Army's annual meeting this year conducted virtually. Iron Mike, start us off as you do every week. Obviously, another chaotic week on the fourth stimulus package, right? I mean, we were seeing it as dead. We've been calling it as dead. We've been seeing it as dead for a while. And yet, Nancy Pelosi and Steve Mnuchin continue to negotiate a deal. So the president wants a bigger deal than Democrats. Mnuchin is under pressure from Republicans for having, quote, caved to Nancy Pelosi, all the while the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Dr. No, as he prides himself on saying, is no deal. What's the vibe on the Hill? What's going on? And how is this going to play out, given that lawmakers of all stripes are under enormous pressure to do a deal?
Well, this is kind of like a bad horror movie. Every time you think it's dead, it comes right back to life again. So at the beginning of the week on Sunday, Speaker Pelosi said that they had to strike a deal within 48 hours. So Speaker Pelosi and Mnuchin were expected to get a deal on Tuesday, whether a relief deal could be done before the election. And Pelosi even briefed Democrats on Monday because she's working really hard to try and get this done. She said to her Democrats, "I want this as soon as possible because I don't want to carry over the droppings of this grotesque elephant into the next presidency." But nevertheless, this self-imposed deadline for a coronavirus deal came and went on Tuesday. But Pelosi insisted in a dear colleague to her members and on television appearances that she and Mnuchin are making real progress and that they have agreed to keep talking. They've talked every day. Committee staff is working around the clock, and she has tasked her committee chairman to start reconciling the differences and work with staff to draft legislation. So legislation is actually being written at this time in case a deal is struck so they can move a bill to the floor quickly. Meanwhile, over in the Senate, on Tuesday, they took pretty much a symbolic vote on extending the authorizations of the Paycheck Protection Program, which had expired back in August. And then on Wednesday, they took up a bill again for $500 billion that would have provided more funds for the PPP, $300 a week extra unemployment insurance and liability protections. And again, that bill failed to get cloture and failed. Despite all that, Pelosi remains optimistic. Earlier yesterday, she said, "Look, we're putting pen to paper and a deal is close." She said, as far as testing, tracing, and the healthcare provisions in the bill, we're about there. On provisions regarding another round of direct payments to individuals, she says, we've come to terms. But Pelosi told the media yesterday that she has not reached an agreement with the White House on state and local aid liability protections for businesses or election and census provisions in the bill. And the cost of this package continues to rise. Remember, the Democrats were at $2.2 trillion. The Republicans, Mnuchin, went up to $1.8 trillion. Now the rumor is the new package is somewhere around $2 trillion. But Meadows and Trump continue to undercut Mnuchin. Yesterday, Meadows started attacking Pelosi by saying she's just looking at this as a way to get her liberal wish list accomplished. And the president tweeted yesterday that a deal should not be a bailout for Democratic states and cities, which in his words are poorly run. And at the debate last night, he attacked Pelosi by saying that she does not want a deal. Now, even if a deal were to come together, it's really not clear whether it would pass the Senate, because we would need 13 Senate Republicans to support it. And Senator Thune, who's the whip, and it's his job to count votes, told reporters the other day that there may not be 13 votes needed to pass this legislation. And McConnell has been urging the White House not to strike a deal with Pelosi before the election. And we're hearing now more and more that Senate Republicans are really livid at Mnuchin as he gets closer and closer to a big ticket deal with Pelosi. At the same time, Pelosi's conference is beginning to demand that she secure the promise of a Senate vote before finalizing any deal. So even if a deal comes together in the next week or so, I would not expect it to be voted on before the election. House Majority Whip Clyburn said, the election is less than 2 weeks away, and I believe we'll be back in Washington a week or two after the election, and we could do something there. But I wouldn't count on action in the lame duck. I think there's some that feel the Democrats would rather just hold out for a better deal under President Biden, and others think that Trump would have little incentive to sign a bill if he loses, because his behavior is so unpredictable. So, look, I think, you know, while this is still alive and on life support, we're in the same position we were last week, that I think a deal is very unlikely.
Byron, let me bring you in. We had a great conversation this week with Eric Fanning, the president of the Aerospace Industries Association, about the kind of impact this is going to have on our part of the ecosystem, particularly on the commercial side, where airlines are announcing extraordinary losses. We've seen some earnings reports, obviously, from the big defense contractors, which you wrote about this week. What's your sense on where we are and what how this is going to be impacting the defense and aerospace ecosystem?
Look, I absolutely agree with Michael. I think, you know, it's almost kind of become a cargo cult within financial markets, at least. You know, the headlines every day are the market's up or down on where the stimulus negotiations are. I almost think, though, right now that you've seen a shift in consensus. This has been moving over a number of weeks, that it almost doesn't matter if you get a deal done now. I mean, if you don't get it done now, sure, there could be some fourth quarter impacts, first quarter potentially in the new year. But, and you know, some of the sectors are clearly going to have to wade through that. Airlines, probably still some more damage to commercial aerospace. Although today there's news that Airbus was actually going to start increasing their commercial airplane production rates. But I think what's happening here is the market's almost looking towards not only a Biden win, but potentially a blue wave. And so that in the first quarter of the new year, you know, Biden, one of his first acts is to get this stimulus through. And that's going to be a lot easier with Democratic majority in the Senate and in the House as well. So I almost think the market's kind of looking over the current impasse between Pelosi, the White House, and the Senate, to another $2 trillion or more to kind of get this thing kickstarted and rolling again.
Gordon, give us your sense and then Dove yours on where we find ourselves and how this is going to be affecting the ecosystem. Dove, you know, I can just imagine, when you were, as comptroller, your views on this. But Gordon, start us off and then let's go to Dove.
Well, I just brief comment. I think we're watching right now a political Japanese no drama. There's a lot of moving around, a lot of spoken words, a lot of apparent action on the stage. But basically, there is no plot. There's nothing happening. We're playing chicken with the election right now on all sides. And whatever the motivation for behaving the way Senator McConnell is behaving, you know, I'm sure he did not bruise his hands duking it out with people on this terrain. He is simply sitting this one out. It just says there's politics going on in this theater, and we're going to, I think, probably not see much come out of it until after the election.
Dove?
I'm inclined to agree. And in the first place, I think both sides are waiting to see what the next Congress is going to look like and who's going to be in the White House. And I don't think the Democrats are particularly going to be in a rush to move if they think they can do better come January. And the Republicans, well, first of all, you begin with a president who, if he loses, I think could very well pursue a scorched earth policy anyway. This is a man who's already said he's ready to leave the country if he loses. Well, he may not leave the country physically, but he may leave it mentally. And so we just don't know. And because of that, and because of all the uncertainty, it just makes sense to assume that nothing's going to happen till after the election. And then the question, of course, becomes, do we get another continuing resolution into, say, February when a new administration can get its act together?
Let's talk a little bit about politics. I mean, obviously, we are in the short strokes of an election, 11 days, I think, if I have my math correct, although I'm sure one of you will correct me. We had a debate last night where national security really didn't play much of a prominent role.
The only substantive discussion was about North Korea, where the president seemed to say that having photo ops with Kim worked, whereas Mr. Biden pointed out that photo ops don't get you anywhere and they're building bigger missiles.
Just two quick points on the debate. Point number one, random reference to foreign policy and national security issues. But if you look at things like climate, immigration topics that did come up, most of these cannot be solved by the United States alone, which is a foreign policy issue. So by implication, that was there. And the other thing is people underestimate the degree to which seeing somebody as a trustworthy, reliable leader is a foreign policy issue in a debate and in a presidential campaign. So leadership is always on stage, even when the topic is not foreign policy.
We've got individual elections. We talked a little bit about how a change in the Senate could really drive some rather tectonic changes in the composition of committees. You know, there are all sorts of questions being asked of Mitch McConnell. You know, Gordon, you mentioned you know, bruised you know, hands that look somewhat less than normal, and the majority leader not addressing that. He's in a tight race, obviously, in Kentucky. Byron, start us off. You know, you wrote a note about some of this changes in composition and what it could mean for defense and aerospace. And I'd like to talk about that a little bit briefly. Go ahead.
Well, I think, you know, we talked a bit about the House. I think, you know, the interesting side of this is really going to be the Senate. Look, if Democrats gain the majority in the Senate, I assume Reid of Rhode Island becomes the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. You know, I don't think there are going to be major changes. There may be very small nuances when you start getting into changes in staff directors and just kind of the day-to-day workings of the committee and kind of what they're going to focus on. I do think, you know, one of the things that, again, reminded me about what could change in the Senate would be on the Foreign Relations Committee. Menendez, and I'm just drawing a blank on who he co-sponsored this, but I think there was a F-35 Exports Act that was floated earlier this week.
Was it Dianne Feinstein?
Yeah, thank you. And so, you know, this whole question about Middle East exports and what are our relations going to be with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, you know, this could be a shift that I think, you know, one of many that can be important. On the appropriation side, you know, maybe at the margin, Shelby of Alabama is currently the chair of appropriations and the defense subcommittee. You know, historically, the shipbuilding industry has done pretty well on Senate appropriations, but I don't think that'll really change. If you look at some of the other staff, some of the other members of that committee, New Hampshire, Hawaii, Virginia, I think they're still going to be well represented. And so I don't think there's going to be a sea change there. But I think the arms sale side is going to be one to watch.
Michael, let me bring you in. I know you have clients in the Middle East, as well as do some work for guys on the F-35 program. But from a strategic level, do you see these shifts having significant impacts? I mean, this, I mean, I have to say the Obama administration was very forward leaning on export reforms, although there were, blocking of sales, for example, to Egypt, as well as to Saudi Arabia and Yemen, obviously, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, because of the Yemen campaign that drew the ire of those countries up ultimately. The Trump administration's sense has been export to all as quickly as possible, because there's economic value there. Obviously, some of the deals that have been closed started going as far back as the Bush administration, so it's unfair to exclusively lay that at the feet of the Trump administration. But give us sort of your sense on how this ball game potentially could change.
So, I think some of this is still, there's hard feelings about the emergency declaration that the president used to move arms sales earlier in the year, or actually last year. And I think, there's a difference now when you have a Republican president, if you have Democratic control of both the House and the Senate and the White House. I mean, for example, look how many times the Republicans repealed Obamacare when Obama was the president. But how many times were they able to repeal Obamacare when they had a Republican president? So it's easy to throw
and
these
bombs. And a Republican
bombs.
House and a Republican
yeah,
Senate.
Exactly, exactly, right? So I think a lot of this proposed legislation is really bomb throwing and messaging. We know that none of these bills are going to become law in this Congress. It has to be reintroduced in the next Congress. And then when they're in charge of governing, I think we're going to see a much different standpoint that the Democrats take. And look, this administration, or the new administration, if there is one, is going to recognize that we need allies. And a way to maintain our relationships overseas is by arms sales. It's a tool of foreign policy, and not only influences behavior of these countries, but also provides interoperability, which is important for us when we're fighting alongside these folks, whether it's a large-scale conflict or in the war on terror, which we're doing right now. So, look, I think there'll be more focus on human rights in this administration. I think we even saw the cover of The Economist this week is all focused on human rights. But I still think we will see foreign weapon sales in this next administration. And they will use them as a tool of foreign policy to get the behavior out of our allies that we're looking for.
Gordon and Dove?
Dove probably has a lot more thoughts on this than I do, but one thought I think is important to keep your eye on is if the Senate goes Democratic. There are a lot of people, Tim Kaine is one of them, who are quite prominent and strong leadership roles, who have focused on the need to fix all of the things that are now wrong with the authorization for the use of military force, and have focused specifically on efforts aimed at stepping back from supporting the Saudis in Yemen. I expect those views to be prominent. I expect them to be put forward, and I expect it to be part of a change that's happening on a relationship with the Saudis in particular.
That's pretty one of the things that I was going to actually mention. I think Gordon's absolutely right. The AUMF is something's going to happen on this whole question of congressional impact on decisions to go to war. Whether it's the AUMF exactly as Tim Kaine sees it or some variation thereof, there will be something if there's a Democratic Senate as well as a Democratic House. And I think Biden will sign off on it if he's elected. I think that Saudi Arabia is more likely to be a target than the UAE, in part because the UAE already completed a deal with Israel, which both sides seem to support. And the Saudis, of course, are the ones who are really involved in Yemen. The UAE pulled out pretty much. And then you still have the Khashoggi business, which the Washington Post will never let anybody forget about. So I think Saudi Arabia is going to be in the crosshairs. Don't forget that the chairman of that committee, of the Appropriations Committee, is going to be Pat Leahy, who traditionally has not been a big fan of foreign military sales to authoritarian countries. And I think Egypt was mentioned earlier. The Democrats don't like Sisi. They say he's worse than Mubarak ever was. And so there may be some pressure on Egypt as well. And finally, I think one of the more interesting questions will be, how will the Democrats react to the sales that Trump is pushing through for Taiwan? On the one hand, there's a lot of support for Taiwan because it's being bullied by the Chinese. But on the other hand, would arms sales of the magnitude that Trump is pushing force the Chinese hand beyond simply looking the other way, which is what they normally do after some squeaks? when we sell arms to Taiwan. So that one's worth watching.
Do you think, Dove, there's any blowback? I mean, obviously, a lot of reports on Turkish as well as Israeli arms being used in the conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan with Turkey backing Baku and Russia, interestingly, not really playing much of a role. There is a lot of conversation about whether or not the United States, you know, obviously there's a meeting with Secretary Pompeo and the Armenian, as well as Azeri foreign ministers here in Washington. But do you think that there is going to be any arms export impact? I mean, have you heard any discussion on that? Because there are, you know, folks on the Hill that I talked to was like, look, you know, I mean, if U.S. Technology is making it into either the Turkish or the Israeli weapons in this conflict, the United States should somehow get involved, but it hasn't been any formal or major declaration.
Well, there's been much less talk about the Israelis than about the Turks, because the Turks are clearly pursuing what you might call a neo-Ottoman policy. They're in Libya, they're in Syria, they're in Iraq, they're trying to bully Israel, Cyprus, and Greece, and Bulgaria. And now they're supporting the Azeris. So I think that's where the focus is going to be. And if the Israelis are cutting new deals, say, with Sudan, there'll be much less push on that. The Israelis are going to be pushed on Palestine, not on Azerbaijan and Armenia. And one other thing, you said that the Russians are playing it low key. In fact, they're the ones right now who are trying to sort out a deal between these two countries because they have influence in both. The United States actually has been trying for decades to sort out the Nagorno-Karabakh issue, and we haven't succeeded. And this is, and again, it's a legacy of Trump. We pull out, Russians and others come in.
Let me take the conversation to the election interference. Obviously, a lot of discussion, for example, of Iranian hacking and disinformation efforts. For example, Democratic voters allegedly getting emails from the Proud Boys saying, hey, we're watching how you vote. Obviously, that's the right-wing militia or domestic terrorist group, depending on how you want to look at it. There were a lot of people who were surprised that Barack Obama sort of returns to the political stage, gives a major address, and then strangely at 7 o'clock, there's a press conference that involves law enforcement officials, including the FBI director, saying, hey, look at this. This is all Iran. 2 days later, we find out that a lot of folks are saying, hey, Iran is a far, far smaller problem than the magnitude of the Russian problem, right? Now getting reports that the Russians actually may have hacked publicly available information in voting systems across the country. And again, there's this sense people have that the FBI and the Justice Department are actually politicized tools instead of the apolitical tools that they're supposed to be, which I can't imagine is a positive development. I can't imagine Chris Wray wanted that, even if, you know, Bill Barr told him, get out there and, you know, the president wants us to take attention away from Barack Obama, who gets under his skin. How problematic is this?
Look, when he came out and said this, and they had this press conference, they also pointed out that both Trump and Biden were targets. And it became very clear within a couple of days that not only was Russia the bigger problem, but Biden was the target and not Trump. And of course, that undermines, again, what the DNI was saying, and it does undermine the FBI's credibility, although the fact that reports have come out that the president wants to fire Wray and maybe even Barr, that shores up the credibility of the FBI. And quite frankly, I think for the rank and file in the FBI, knowing that their director is now in the president's crosshairs probably improves morale.
Gordon?
On this one, I think the most disturbing feature of all of this to me really isn't whether the Russians are interfering or whether the Iranians are interfering. Of course they are, and of course there's evidence. The timing of this, but particularly the use of the intelligence apparatus and the Department of Justice as political backdrops for what the president wants to accomplish politically this year, is pretty unusual in the history of American politics. And it goes along with something I know you're going to talk about in a bit, which is the use of the military as a political backdrop as well. The Trump presidency has mobilized institutions that have typically been kind of hands-off about their role in politics and pushed them right into the front.
Byron, any wrap-up thoughts on the arms export issue, and then your sense on this one?
Yeah, no, I'll go back. I absolutely agree with Michael. I mean, I don't want to suggest that we're going to somehow shut down arms exports in a Biden administration. And, you know, clearly Senate Foreign Relations is one of many committees. But I think, you know, in some of the markets, you know, if I look at some of the companies and segments that have done quite well in a Trump administration, precision guided weapons at Lockheed Martin and Raytheon were two that really stood out, and they were beneficiaries of exports to that part of the world. And there are going to be some interesting ones that coming up. I mean, Canada's going to make an F-30 a decision on a new fighter program, so I assume that'll probably go to the F-35. You know, there are a couple others in Europe and in Finland and Switzerland that are coming up that are kind of interesting. And, you know, the optics of a Biden administration kind of trying to promote closer alliance relationships might actually help some of those sales get over the line.
The fact is that when we have foreign military sales of a significant number, that lowers the flyaway cost of our systems.
Yeah.
And right. In one respect, any kind of interference with the major sales to the Middle East, and they have been major, and they have benefited Raytheon, but not just Raytheon, and really most companies, because you've got all the subcontractors as well, and the third tier and so on. If that gets cut back, that's going to drive the cost of our own purchases up. And given that we've already got budget crunch troubles in the defense budget, that's not necessarily a good thing. And what's interesting here is that the Foreign Relations Committee doesn't worry about that, but the Armed Services Committee certainly do.
I want to change the topic to civil military relations in the couple of minutes we've got left in the show. Chris, thanks for joining us. Obviously, this is a topic you and I have been discussing for very many years, and everybody else on the panel has been thinking about, I know as well. Troy Aikman and Joe Buck were overheard on an open mic, obviously the nation's two leading football commentators. I believe the airplane was a C-130 flying over an empty football stadium, and them saying, God, you know, how much does that cost? And one or the other, you know, sort of was picked up. You know, I don't think that'll, you know, last in a Biden administration. And flyovers have been increasingly controversial. And even, in fact, we discussed on this program, tone deaf when the Thunderbirds and the Blue Angels flew over, you know, to support first responders. At the end of the day, the question many people were left asking was, how much is that costing? And can't you buy me that much money in PPE and send it to me, please, for example, at that time, right? I mean, it was seen as a tone-deaf step. The Lafayette Park issue has played into this. I know that the military leadership is a little bit concerned that military members, because of the level of compensation, may think of themselves as superior to the society they serve. And in fact, in some of these cases, we're beginning to see that in terms of right-wing militia involvement, right? We are patriots. We are the defenders. You guys are scum. It's unfortunately manifesting. I mean, that's not a majority opinion, certainly for those who serve nobly and gallantly in uniform. And there are vast numbers that serve, you know, in order for the service, not for the benefits that come with it. Give us, you know, Aikman and Buck both sort of stepped away from it, said, hey, you know, we support the military. We don't mean that that way. How does this play into that broader debate? What do you think of it? And I just want to quickly go around the horn with folks, right? Because the flyover thing, the patriotism thing, or maybe some would say even the contrived vision of patriotism, you know, came from 9/11. And a lot of it was driven by, well, thank God I'm not going and my kids aren't going. So heap benefits and praise on all the people who are willing to, you know, go into this meat grinder four or five times in a row.
first of all, thanks for the opportunity to talk about this, because I think it's an important one. And as Gordon's comments just a few seconds ago alluded to, there are a lot of different threads to this. The problem is really, as I said, where Gordon was going, and that is when these outreach efforts are seen as overtly political, when a flyover at a stadium or when troops, you know, greeting their commander in chief is viewed through the lens of politics, because that's what the leadership has set them up to become, then the real value of this engagement is lost. As a career communicator and as a former public affairs officer, the value of these engagement tools is very high when executed correctly. And so I think that it's a shame that we will likely throw the baby out with the bathwater as folks react to the use of the military in a way that's inappropriate. But I think that what you heard from Troy Aikman and Joe Buck is probably what a lot of people are thinking after events, like you said, with the Blue Angels and with the Thunderbirds and other uses of the military that make people scratch their head. So it's a shame. We were at a moment in which the military and the civilian population were maybe coming together, and people were starting to at least want to understand more and want to show appreciation. And now I think we're starting to see trends where it's going in the other direction, which is bad for both sides. We don't want to get into a more of an us and them situation, whether it's over politics, whether it's over money, or whether it's over a lack of understanding about service. That's not good for the country.
Dove?
I certainly agree with that. A couple of thoughts. The first is, you may remember the old Budweiser commercial where somebody's coming through the airport and they're wearing uniform and everybody claps their hands. I still think that that's the overwhelming sense in this country. There really are two different problems here. One is, what's the attitude of the military to civilians? And I think that, yes, there is an element, and there always has been, quite frankly, that looks down on civilians, you know, like naval people used to look down on landlubbers. I don't think that's the majority view at all. I was on the Personnel Compensation Commission some years back, and we spoke to all sorts of people in uniform as to why they joined up. Many join up because their dads and granddads did, or uncles, and now, of course, mothers. And many join up for patriotism, and yes, many join up because of the benefits. Congress is not going to take away those benefits for the very simple reason that if you start cutting the benefits, you're not going to get the best people. We have a right now, of course, a huge unemployment problem, but as soon as employment's going to tick up again, the military is going to have to compete with the commercial sector for the best and the brightest. So I don't think benefits are going to go down. So that's one issue here. The second issue is the abuse of the military for political purposes. That's what Trump has done. That's why Troy Aikman said what he did. I guarantee you, if the military did not have all these backup props for Trump, which they don't necessarily want, in fact, we know they don't want it, but if that wasn't going on, I wonder whether Troy Aikman, who's a very, very popular broadcaster and was a terrific football player, whether Aikman would have said and Buck would have said what they said.
Gordon, want to get your sense. Byron, your sense. And then Michael, if you want to help us end this. Right, because, I mean, there's a sense that flyovers help in a recruiting capacity. And certainly nobody is making the case that, you know, that the service isn't welcome nor should be appropriately compensated. I think the counterpoint is that anytime you even begin to discuss whether or not military compensation or the nature of that compensation should be curtailed in any fashion, it's sort of, why do you hate the troops? As opposed to saying, hey, wait a minute, in any one of a number of these jobs, military people actually make more than they do in the civilian world, which in a certain sense is also contributing a little bit to the whole notion of veteran and military unemployment. And in fact, I mean, people can't sort of afford to leave the military in some cases. Gordon, your view, Byron, and then Michael, bring us home.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I think this is there's some separate issues here that, need to be looked at separately, but it is a very big ball of wax and very deeply embedded in American society. I was, when I was in the Clinton White House, I was the OMB briefer that they would trot out when budgets went down every year to stand in room 250 in the old executive office building and explain to the representatives of the retiree associations and the veterans associations and so on what the president was proposing in terms of benefits and the structure of benefits. Fits for the military, and I have the spear points to prove it. The benefits are seriously fought for. When I talked at the Naval Postgraduate School as the OMB representative and did the Commandant's lecture and talked about national security and budgeting for national security, every single question afterwards was about benefits. Why have you cut this? Why are you taking that down? Blah, blah, blah. So there is a kind of a sense of entitlement about these benefits that is politically, as Dove says, very powerful. You're not going to do much to change it. There's a second set of issues, which is the penetration of this sense of using the military being a central player in American life, which I see a lot here in Brunswick, because we used to have the Brunswick Naval Air Station in Maine, and the flyovers were constant, and there were 3,000, 5,000 military personnel living in town, and people were embraced the military, were very welcoming to the military, and some of that residually hangs on. I went on the Brunswick Police Department website the other day and noted that there were four police officers in the photograph as the backdrop on the website, standing in front of a fighter plane. I looked at the fighter plane and said, that's an F-22. That's not a plane that was ever based in Brunswick. What on earth is the Brunswick Police Department doing portraying itself in front of an F-22? Last time I looked, the 1033 program in the Department of Defense was not providing F-22s to any police department that I know of. So there's that level at which we just see it almost seamlessly throughout American society. And then there's the third piece, which is the one that some of this discussion is focused on, which is using the military as a political tool. And whether it's sending people to the border, it's putting flags and soldiers behind people, this particular administration has abused this, in my judgment, to a fare thee well. But I got to say, mea culpa, this goes back a good 30 years at least, when the Clinton administration, the Clinton campaign running for office, decided having Admiral Crowell, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and a bunch of other retired brass behind him validating his campaign for the presidency. I was uncomfortable with it then. I was uncomfortable with Admiral Crowell's choice. I wouldn't deny any retired officer the right to speak his or her mind. But it was an introduction of a political activity for which the military acted as a, quote, validator, unquote, which has been a slippery slope, frankly, ever since, right down to this particular president initially recruiting a bunch of brass, peppering his administration with it to lend credibility to the administration. That's a very dangerous slippery slope. It ended with the Lafayette Square March. And it makes, I think, a lot of senior people in the military uncomfortable now to suddenly turn around and say, look, this is a little bit further than we thought this was going to go. This may not be good for American democracy.
I should point out that no president was better at using troops as a backdrop than Ronald Reagan was. All right, we've got a couple of more minutes left. Byron, thoughts? Michael, thoughts? And then I'm going to go back to Chris, because I think he's got two points that he wants to close us out on. Go ahead.
Look, I don't think the flyers in and of themselves, it's a data point. I would agree with some of the trends that have been discussed. From my perspective, some of the things that I see and what I've heard really over the last couple of years, I remember when General Milley was chief of staff of the Army, he used to bemoan the fact that a lot of the people who are enlisting in the Army kind of came from this L-shaped line that you could draw through the United States. It really ran down the backbone of the Rockies and then through the Southeast. And I know under his leadership and then under Esper when he was Secretary of Army, they really tried to to broaden that recruitment net. And I think, the fact that in a lot of ways, the military has become more divorced from society at large. I grew up in the New York metropolitan area. Brooklyn Navy Yard. I lived in San Francisco for a while, so we had Alameda Naval Air Station, Mare Island. I mean, all these facilities where you just, the presence of the military wasn't during Fleet Week or during a Memorial Day parade, or during a flyover at a football game or a baseball game or a tennis tournament. And there's a side to me I sometimes wish that maybe I'll go back to John Lehman and kind of sprinkling military facilities, in his case, naval facilities around the country. I think there's something wholesome about having a military facility, to Gordon's point, an air station, naval air station in Brunswick, where you're living side by side by people who serve. And we've kind of isolated and divorced ourselves, I think, in ways are not that healthy for a democracy.
One of the other things I would point out, a great point, as a fellow New Yorker, I do remember Brooklyn Navy Yard. One of the only times I would ever go to Brooklyn was to go to Brooklyn Navy Yard as a Manhattanite. And I will also point out, right, people's question is, at a time when you're talking about not enough funding for readiness, geriatric air forces, right? I mean, there's this concern that, hey guys, you know, you're adding up flying hours and burning up flying hours and maintenance hours to do this, because there's no such thing as a 1 hour flight. I mean, even though you can justify that as part of a training regimen and flying around the flagpole. Michael, and then Chris.
Well, I think, you know, Troy Aikman was correct to question the value of a flyover over an empty stadium, especially when these things are so expensive. And frankly, you know, these flyovers are special. And I think Chris was spot on when he said there's value, a high value to these tools when executed correctly. And as you mentioned, you know, there's value in recruiting. I mean, one of my early jobs in defense and politics was working in the Pentagon in the office that had oversight of recruiting, where I learned that these were recruiting tools. So are the air shows. The Blue Angels and the Thunderbirds also are recruiting tools. To have people take a look at that and say, wow, I want to be a part of that, and to draw a connection between the civilians and their defense community. And there are also things that give people pride in their country, just like our space program does. Who people question that. Same thing with the Olympics. These are all things that I think combined, you know, help the military recruit and also give people a sense of pride in this country. But they have to be used judiciously.
Chris, parting thoughts?
What I take away, in addition to what politicians have done, their role in politicizing the military, is I can't help but ask, as a veteran and a recent retiree, what the military, though, needs to do. There are going to be lots of lessons learned post-Trump, whether that's in a couple months or whether it's in a couple years, with what has changed, good and bad, in this country. I think most people would agree on the bad side is the political activities in which the military has been encouraged to participate in. But I think those in the military and those that have in the civilian world that have immediate oversight of the military really need to look at that institution and make changes or make commitments that they can't allow that to stand. I mean, I've heard so many excuses from folks that I know that are still in uniform that are, well, this is the commander in chief, and yeah, it's not exactly an illegal order. I just think that mindset has to change if you are ever to dial it back to some level of acceptable nature. And all of these other issues are fringe issues, but at the heart of it is, what type of military do we want? Do we want it to be political? Do we want it to look like banana republics that we've bemoaned for years? Or do we want it to be in the tradition of what we think our military is like? That's going to take commitment on both the civilian side and the military side.
Great topic, and one that's worth further plumbing. I would note, right, that the John S. McCain, the White House had apparently asked for it to be moved or hidden somehow, so that the president didn't have to see a ship named after somebody who he considered a nemesis, alas. Everybody, thanks very, very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Hope everybody has a great weekend, and look forward to having you back on again next week. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vago.
Thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.